Fan Junkies Radio is brought to you by FanJunkies.net, where sports meet social networking. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Fan Junkies Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan Ragus. Alongside me, as always, Mr. McShane, Mike McShane. What's going on, Mike?
Hey, how are we doing today, Jonathan? A lot of sports today, I'll tell you.
Oh, yeah. You know, we got some great news this weekend, too, Mike.
Oh, man, alive. It just loaded today.
Yeah.
And then, you know, cap it all off, we got a national championship to play tonight, so.
Absolutely, absolutely. But you know what? Before we get into anything, we just want to say, you know, today we have a very good guest,
yep.
You know, movie producer, basketball coordinator, casting, technical advisor, writer, director, basically the jack of all trades.
Yeah, he sure is.
Yeah, Nate Bellamy. He's going to join us today to talk about his new movie, Renaissance Men, which you know, is basically about the history of the Harlem Rens.
Yep.
You know, a lot of basketball history there. So he's going to join us at about the 12:15 mark here on Fan Junkies Radio today and, you know, basically tell listeners, you know, if you don't know who the Harlem Rens are, Nate will tell you about them. If you do, listen, because he's going to have a lot of information about the movie and even some great stories about him and, you know, some former Rens players like John Isaacs and such. So that's going to be really good. Also, Wednesday, we have WFAN Jets reporter Crystal Presti is going to join us to talk about the New York Jets. You know, what's going to happen tomorrow at the press conference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are they going to fire Tony Sperano? Is Rex Ryan going to stay? Who's going to be the new GM and whatnot? Also on Friday, WIFL Women's Indoor Football League Commissioner Dion Lee is going to be joining us. And, you know, not only are we going to learn about the WIFL, but we might have some possible big news to announce as well.
Very possible.
Three big shows this week. And also we have some even more guests for next week, but we'll get to that later on in a week. But you know what? Before we talk to Nate, before we talk basketball, the NHL lockout is over. We have hockey, Mike.
Yay!
I'm not so happy.
We know there's a lot of hockey fans out there. We've heard from a lot of them over the past couple of months. You and I are hockey fans, and we both have a lot of followers of us that are hockey fans. I'd like to hear from them. How do they feel about this? I got to be honest, Jonathan. When the news came down the other day, I was like, okay. I mean, really, that was it. That's my sense on it. You know, I'm kind of at a point where I really don't care.
Yeah.
You know,
you and a lot of other people.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it. We've talked about the concept that, okay, it's going to be a shortened season. I've asked the question, you know, if your team wins in a shortened season, is that a cheap one?
Yes.
You know, we've had these kinds of discussions. It drug on and became so anticlimactic after a while that now it's there. Okay, fine. So what? You know.
Well, you know what. Before you go on, let me ask this, because, you know, we did talk about, okay, whatever. It's the lockout. If it comes back, it's a shortened season. If you win the cup, do you have bragging rights? Would you even be happy about winning that cup, et cetera, et cetera? But if you look at last season, it took the Los Angeles Kings, who went on to win the Stanley Cup, possibly about the last three games of the season to get into the playoffs.
Right.
This year, 48 games is what they're talking about, starting on January 19th with camps opening up possibly this Saturday. The playoffs start right now, Mike.
Well, I guess...
Right?
Yeah, I guess you could look at it that way. Of course, you know, let's see what kind of condition the players are in. You know, that's gonna slant it a lot, too.
Well, you know, considering a lot of these players are playing overseas, we're playing in the AHL over here, but not at that, you know, also skating by themselves with their teammates and playing scrimmage games, I think they'll be okay from a conditioning standpoint, but will they be okay from an actual hockey skill standpoint?
Yeah, but you and I talked about that before, and if I'm not mistaken, I forget if it was either yourself or maybe it was somebody that we had on who came on afterward and corrected and said, you know, wait a minute, let's get it straight. A lot of the ones that were playing overseas were really some of the bigger stars. The majority of players have not been playing.
Yeah. Well, no, absolutely not. The majority of players have not been playing. But if you look at, like, let's take the Rangers, for example, you know, they've been doing, you know, team organizational skates, practices and scrimmages and whatnot at a local rink in Long Island. So they've been getting, you know, so the guys who weren't playing anywhere overseas, they were getting together to try to keep themselves in shape and you know, and conditioned for a possible return of the NHL. So I think some players will be gassed at the beginning of the year. But for the ones that have been skating, have been playing or whatnot, which is, you know, a decent chunk of players, Mike, I think they'll be okay. But there'll be some players that you'll see really gassed, and it's going to take them a while to get going.
Yeah, you know, that's fine. We'll see how it goes. I don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm probably going to, you know, I'm going to check out the games. I'm going to watch.
And the people who say they're not going to watch, they're going to end up watching.
Well, you know, there's no better playoff than NHL playoffs. But at the same time, I still kind of feel that there's a bit of a hangover that works on this one a little bit.
Because you were one of the people that were in favor of the NBA lockout and the shortened season, and you said it made for a more exciting season last year.
I think it did there. Yeah.
You don't think that'll be the case for the NHL?
It may.
Now listen, I know two totally different games from a conditioning standpoint and from an energy standpoint, but is there a possibility? Because like I said, once January 19th comes, the playoffs are going to start. There's not going to be, you know, month and a half where, okay, well, you know, you could get yourself together and then start to win games. No, you're going to have to start winning games January 19th.
Sure.
So, you know, is there a possibility that this can make for an exciting schedule?
Well, no, and you and I have talked about this. Yeah. I've actually indicated that I feel that an 82-game season is too long.
Yes, you did.
And I think an 82-game season in NBA is too long. I would prefer to probably see something more like a 62-game season.
Yeah.
Or a 60-game season. But now we're talking about 48. And I guess we're just going to have to wait and see how it plays out. I'm going to check it out. I just think the whole manner in which the whole proceeding has taken place has left a very, very, very bad taste in my mouth.
Well, yeah, but, and a lot of other people. So
yeah. I'm
always gonna watch. I'm always gonna be a Rangers fan until the day I die. I'd like to say I have the luxury of saying, well, I'm not gonna watch because I'm upset about it. No, but you know, running Ranger Nation for the last 12 years, a lot of people depend on our website and our Twitter account and whatnot for New York Rangers information. So it's
right.
You know, unfortunately, I don't have the luxury to say, well, I'm not going to watch no more. You know, like you know, some of these other fans, and I'm doing that with quotations in my fingers. Because, listen, whether you're upset at whatever, the lockout or whatnot, if you're a true fan and true lover of the game, I don't see how you cannot watch.
Yeah, well.
You know? Because if you're that desperate to watch hockey to say, well, you got to get something going, I need my hockey, but then it comes out and I say, well, I'm not going to watch because you're back. Then why did you say just minutes before that you need your hockey fix?
But see, then we're all just then we become the sheep that both Bettman and Fair
we have
we were.
Sheep for many years, Mike. And I hate to say it, when it comes to at least the NHL, they're going to, you know, the fans there are going to continue to be sheep. Because like we said too, you know, why is there not one faction getting together, joining up and grouping up all the fans and really doing something big here?
Yeah, well,
instead of multiple people going out and saying, well, instead of getting with, you know, this one fan organization, I'm going to go out and make my own. Right there, you're putting a divide in the fans. Mm-hmm. So to me, you know, I say they're going to continue to be sheep unless they can finally do something as an organized base. Until then, I just don't see many people not watching NHL. I guarantee you there's going to be a lot of people watching it.
There will. I'll be curious to see in the end whether ratings drop off this year. I think they probably will.
I think ratings will suffer in the beginning, possibly the first 3 to 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
After that, no.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
I think it's going to be fine. You know, I don't think it's going to be up to the standards of last year, but I think it's going to be such a minimal percentage of people that are missing from that demographic that I don't even think they're going to worry about it. Because it's hockey, and because the fans that are hardcore, legit fans outweigh the ones that are saying right now, I'm not going to watch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're outweighing them by a drastic measure. So
I don't know if you took a look over the details of what's been proposed as far as the CBA goes.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly, one of the things that you and I both pointed out was going to be the stumbling block was in the most recent owner's proposal was the salary cap. And you and I read over the last proposal that was put forth by the owners. We read through it, and we both came away saying, okay, it sounds fair. But then we both stopped when we read what the salary cap was, and we said, uh-uh, that ain't going to work.
Yes.
And, in fact, in the new proposal, that's exactly – where a big portion of the stumbling block was. In the first year, the salary cap is up to $70.2 million. By year two, it would drop down to $64.3 million. And I think it's – I'm not sure exactly whether it holds there or whether it's a sliding scale in subsequent years. But this is a 10-year deal, apparently, with an opt-out after year eight, I believe.
Yes.
Plus,
you know what? I actually like the whole draft lottery thing that they threw in there.
I was just going to throw that. Yeah, I was just going to throw that out there. That's another new little wrinkle in there. We're going to have a 14 non-playoff team lottery for the number one pick.
Yes.
In the draft, a la the NBA and how they've been doing that since what?
Well, I mean, listen, the Edmonton Oilers can't have the first pick every year for 15 years.
No, right.
You know what I mean? So to me, I think that's fair.
Absolutely,
you know,
so. Absolutely. So I kind of like that. Olympic participation will be dealt with outside of the new contract. Teams will reportedly receive two amnesty-type style buyouts.
Yes.
Over the course of the next two seasons.
Exactly, which could be used over the next couple of seasons. So.
Exactly, which I think that is beneficial. Contracts are capped, I believe, at 7 years.
Yes.
That is,
you know what, we saw
contract.
And listen, we saw the buyouts, you know, work really well with the NBA. You know,
right.
Teams were able to get rid of players that signed such big deals years ago, and they're,
right.
You know, a shell of their former selves. Now they were able to get them off the roster. But not only that, to me, that gives, you know, that opens up a spot on the roster for somebody more deserving.
Correct.
Which is why I like that amnesty-style buyout. So
the NBA, I believe, had, was it one per team?
One per team, which is why you saw guys like Gilbert Arenas and
right.
You know, all these disgusting contracts get bought out. You know,
right. So. And now in the NHL, they've got two in this one. And I think that is a direct result of the fact that the owners recognize that there are far, far, far too many enormous contracts floating out there in the market.
You look at the contract that, what was it? I think Buffalo signed with Christian Eroff.
Okay.
You know, I mean, come on, man. That Christian Eroff was not deserving of that contract. You know what
you
I mean?
Gotta,
you know, it was just such a 10-year deal.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, even the one that the Islanders gave Rick DiPietro, I mean, it's their stupidity for doing it. You know, but at the same time, like, seriously? Come on.
Yeah, we've got a similar situation like that here in Philadelphia with one humongous goaltender. So,
well, there you go. I mean, you know what? Would you see them using that?
I think potentially they could. I mean, given two of them, yeah. I think they could.
Seasons, you know, not, maybe not this season, but next year.
Correct.
Could that be a good possibility? That they,
correct.
You know, buy out your Brizgalov over here in Philly.
Exactly. Now, I think it's two. They get two buyouts in the course of the next two seasons. So they would have to be used within those two seasons. Otherwise, I guess they get lost.
That's right. With the Rangers, everybody's already speculating they're going to finally get rid of Wade Redden.
Right.
You know, so we'll see what happens. But, I mean, you know what? I think, you know, between the amnesty buyout and the draft lottery, I really like those two additions to this new CBA agreement.
Yeah, it should make it more interesting.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, the draft lottery, I think, is kind of a neat concept.
Yes, it is.
I think that's a neat concept.
It is. Like I say, you know, or, you know, Edmonton getting the first round pick almost every year and still being, you know, finishing last place every other year. It's like, come on, you know.
Well, and hopefully there's a benefit in something like that to some of what we hear about the small market teams.
Yeah.
You know, those ones that are struggling. Hopefully you get a chance to see some of those teams being the beneficiary of higher draft picks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know what? I didn't even think about that. And that's, you know, you just hit the nail on the head. I mean, these small market teams are the ones that were pushing for a further lockout because the bigger owners just wanted to get going. And they're like, no, you know what, we need a higher salary cap or we need a lower
right.
whatever. But that's something that's only going to benefit those teams.
Absolutely. And it might
have
been
the Flyers, the Red Wings, you know, whatnot. They're, you know what, they're not going to be at the bottom of the heap and they're not going to have to worry about
right.
the draft
right.
salary, you know.
So I think that could have been, that actually may have been more of a, like an olive branch that they were tossing out there to some of the quote unquote, like I said, small market teams, the Columbuses, the Phoenixes.
Yes.
You know, so we'll see how it goes. Right now we're looking at the potential start date of January 19th. Is that what you said, Jonathan?
The 19th.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the 19th with camps supposedly, if everything goes the way it's supposed to go, then camps would open up this Saturday.
Right.
So,
right.
48-game schedule, so we'll see what happens. But, you know, let's get to our guest. And right now on the line we have Nate Bellamy, the movie
yep.
maker who's making the movie Renaissance Men. Nate, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jonathan, for having me. It's a pleasure to be on Fan Junkies Radio this afternoon. How are you guys doing?
Real good, Nate. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, we're doing real good. And, you know, Nate, you and I talked a few weeks ago. You know, we spoke basketball. We spoke Harlem Rens. We spoke about the Renaissance Men. And, you know, you and I, both New York products. So we spoke a little bit about that, too. And you had a lot of great stories. I enjoyed listening to him, but you know what? Let's have our listeners enjoy listening to him. First, why don't you tell people a little bit about you and your background?
Okay, I'm a native New Yorker from Brooklyn, born and raised in New York City.
Yep.
I went to IS-320, which is now Jackie Robinson Middle School,
mm-hmm.
and I went to Lafayette High School.
Mm-hmm.
And Lafayette High School is known for Sandy Koufax, the great Hall of Fame baseball player,
Absolutely.
And Larry King. And when I was in high school, they did a documentary movie about my high school team my senior year.
Mm-hmm.
We were one of the best teams in the city. We went to the PSAL championship 2 years in a row with a record of 44-4.
Yeah.
And then from there, I went to school in California, played for Cal State LA, was a all-conference player, and got into the movie-making business.
In which you did a lot in the movie-making business, so why don't you tell people some of the titles that you had a hand in helping make?
Okay, some of the movies that I've been in range from Predator 2 to Space Jam, Love and Basketball. Some of the movies that I had more than just being an actor in, but also being part of the production in terms of helping with casting and coordinating would be Rebound, the HBO movie about Earl the Man of Goat.
Yep.
And also Space Jam.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, and we spoke about that. I mean, you know, Mike, I don't know if you ever watched it, The Legend of Earl the Goat Manigault. Phenomenal story. You know, basketball history at its best right there.
No, but I'm looking through Nate's background here, and I see you had some background, or you did some work with the Hank Gather story as well.
Yes, I did.
And that one I am familiar with. I do recall that one.
Yeah.
There was
yeah.
another one in here I'm looking for as well. I when I was reading it through this morning, there was something else that grabbed my eye that I had remembered greatly. It'll come to me in a second, but the Hank Gather story. When was that work done?
Well, it was done shortly after his death,
right.
and it was a TV movie of the week,
right?
Wow. Type of deal,
yeah.
And then it was a good movie. Bo Kimble had a lot to do with it because
mm-hmm.
he was Hank's best friend.
Yep.
And we basically kind of told the story of them growing up in Philadelphia and then coming to Los Angeles and both playing for Loyola Marymount, how that came about. And, of course, it ended with his tragic death.
Yeah. And, see, I'm a Philly guy, so obviously that one grabbed my attention.
Good. These are good stories. These are kind of stories that really transcend the sport of basketball. You know, even though basketball is what the characters played, but the stories are really about some simple truths, and they're stories about life. And these stories have a universal message, and that's what it's all about.
Yeah. And you know what? It's stories that not even basketball fans even really know. You know, just taking you know, the Earl the Goat Manigault. You know, not many people heard about Earl Manigault, you know.
Right, right.
So it was nice that, you know, somebody was able to focus on a legendary icon like Earl Manigault and was able to make a movie and really put it out there, because now there's people, you know, who are in their early 30s now and whatnot.
Right, right.
They know of Earl the Goat Manigault because of that movie.
Right, right. And also in the film, in the beginning of the film, we had Chick Hearn and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Yes.
Because we wanted to let the audience know Earl Manigault's impact on the game of basketball to the point that somebody as great as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar considered him to be a legend.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was.
And the message of his story was that he was a great talent who had a great fall, but then rose up again to help other people to live a better life, and to use basketball as a vehicle. So that was the message of that story.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're talking about basketball history here and all of these movies leading people to look into all these other great aspects of basketball history. Let's talk about the Harlem Wrens, Nate, because you're making a movie now about the Harlem Wrens. They played at the Renaissance Ballroom in Harlem many, many, many moons ago.
Yes.
You know, why don't you tell listeners, who were the Harlem Wrens, how did they begin, and what they meant to basketball?
Okay. Well, first of all, the Harlem Wrens, which was also known as the New York Renaissance or the Wrens, were a team that was founded in 1922, who came out of what was called the Black Fives era.
Mm-hmm.
And the Black Fives era was something that started in the early 1900s. And it was, you know, basically like a social club that centered around the game of basketball. And the reason why it was called the Black Fives era was that normally teams had no more than 8 players.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a team of 8. It wasn't a team of 10 or 12, but basically no more than 8 players. And not only did you have basketball games, the basketball games was like the center of an event. Like you would have a picnic, a dance. So it was more than just basketball. It was almost like a social event.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what the Wrens came out of. And their owner, his name is Robert Douglas, who they call Smiling Bob, was a guy from St. Kitts, who when he first was introduced to basketball, he fell in love with it.
Yeah.
And he started the New York Wrens. Excuse me. And the reason why he called them the Renaissance was there was a ballroom called the Renaissance Ballroom and Casino.
Yeah.
And he needed a place for them to play. So he went to the owner, and he suggested that his team could play there and that they would call themselves the Renaissance and therefore also promote his business.
Yeah.
So the owner said, sure. Now, in order for them to make money, they had to do what they call barnstorm.
Mm-hmm.
And they would barnstorm throughout the Midwest and South, meaning they would play maybe a handful of games at the Renaissance Casino, like, you know, during Thanksgiving, New Year's Eve. And then from that point on, they would go out on the road for months and barnstorm throughout the country.
Yeah.
And they would play every day and sometimes twice on Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I mean, just looking at their team record, I mean, they started in, 1923, and I believe they disbanded in, 1949?
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, Mike, I don't know if you looked at their team record, 2,588 wins with only 539 losses.
That's incredible.
I mean, seriously, you don't hear about stuff like that. I mean, in the 32-33 regular season, they went 120-8.
And Nate, talk to me, what type of teams were they actually playing against? Obviously, you've indicated they were playing against all white teams. It's rather reminiscent, I guess, of the baseball Negro League, right?
Exactly. Now, the situation was this. They had some professional leagues at that time.
Yeah.
But those leagues wouldn't allow the Wrens to be a part of their league, you know, partly because they were black.
Yeah.
So they played a lot of the teams, professional teams, that played in these leagues, all right, who also were barnstorming teams as well sometimes. They played against John Wooden's team. And John Wooden's team was a barnstorming team out of Indiana.
Right.
And they would normally play those type of teams. Sometimes they would play some college teams,
mm-hmm.
okay? Because, you know, like you said, you know, they have a schedule where they play 100 and maybe 20 games in a season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in 1932, 1933, they won 88 games in 86 days.
Wow.
All on the road. Now, when people hear that, I don't think it really process that an NBA season is only 82 games, and they play that within 6 to 8 months.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And they played more than an NBA season in 86 days and won every game and played a couple of extra games, and all these games were on the road, never having a home game, traveling up to an average of 100 to 200 miles a day.
Yes. In a bus, in terrible weather.
Right. But think about physically being able to play that many games and play it at a very high level.
Yeah.
And what the Rens are known for is being the first world champions of professional basketball. There was a tournament in 1939 held in Chicago. It was called the World Professional Basketball Tournament. Mm-hmm. And they had like 12 teams, and they had two black teams, the Rens and the Harlem Globetrotters, and the Rens won that to become the first recognized basketball champions of the world, which means the New York Renaissance are the first world champions that New York City ever had.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow. Look at that, man. You see, nobody knows.
Pardon me?
Go ahead, Mike.
No, I was going to say the competition then, Nate, that you were talking about, that competition that they were playing against, these weren't teams that were pickup teams.
These
were professional or semi-pro types of teams.
Right. No, they were really professional teams. Matter of fact, one of their number one rival was the original Celtics, which was a team out of New York City.
Yeah.
Okay. And when you look at the early beginnings of basketball, the best team in basketball would be the original Celtics, and their heyday was the 20s.
Yeah.
And then in the 30s, the Rens took over, then they became the best team. And one of the reasons why they became the best team is they played against teams like the original Celtics, and they learned from their battles.
Yeah.
And you know, to become a champion, you got to be the champion.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you know what? We got to tell listeners, too, that the original Celtics, no relation to the Boston Celtics. I mean,
right,
that
no
was a
relation.
Totally different team,
right.
Different league,
right.
And everything.
Right. And they were out of New York City.
Yes. Absolutely.
When people hear Celtics, they think Boston.
Yeah. Well, you know what? That's the thing. When everybody thinks basketball, they automatically think of the NBA. They never think of the Eastern Basketball League. They never think of the Metropolitan Basketball League. I mean, there was a lot of leagues in those days.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And you know, and like you said, a lot of barnstorming professional teams.
Right. Now, another significance to the Rens and their significance to basketball as it is played over the years and especially today is they were the team that was credited for really creating the motion offense.
Yes.
Ball player movement.
Mm-hmm.
Ball player movement, which you don't see a lot of in today's basketball. I mean, today's basketball, we see a lot of guys, you know, all they want, you know, the first thing they want to do and the last thing they want to do is dribble.
Yeah.
The Rens came up with a motion offense where they rarely dribble. They pass and move and cut, pass and move and cut. And then John Isaac, whose nickname was Boy Wonder, was credited with being the creator of the pick and roll, the most devastating play in basketball when you execute it right, the most unstoppable play, I should say.
Yeah. And which, you know, we spoke about, too, and I know you said John Wooden was on some of those teams back in those days. I mean, you saw John Wooden take some of what the Rens did.
Yes.
He was students at not only UCLA, but Indiana State when he was there before UCLA.
Right. And I'm glad you mentioned you mentioned that because when the Rens played, they were so well known and had such a reputation that a lot of high school and college coaches would come to their games and sit up in the stands and diagram their plays and then try to teach their teams to play like the Rens. So that's a very important point to point out to your listeners.
Well, absolutely, because you know John Wooden was such a legendary coach, and you know what? Good for him. You know, in his own right, he was. I mean, John Wooden is John Wooden, but you know, if you look at today's NBA and the players that came out of, you know, Indiana State and UCLA in those days, they're doing what the Wrens started.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Wasn't that the same style of play, though, that we saw as well from the early Harlem Globetrotters? Weren't they more of a ball movement type of a team?
I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm glad you said that about the Harlem Globetrotters. It's interesting that when people, today, when they think of the Harlem Globetrotters, I mean, they have to be, without question, the most famous basketball team in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, wouldn't you say? Harlem Globetrotters.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody's
absolutely.
Heard of it.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But very few people know the story that if it wasn't for the Wrens, there would be no Harlem Globetrotters.
Yeah.
Okay? The Harlem Globetrotters came about because of the Wrens.
Mm-hmm.
Abe Saperstein, who eventually was credited for starting the Harlem Globetrotters, there was a guy in Chicago, had a team called the Spartan Five, and he wanted to get more basketball games for his basketball team because he wanted his team to be more like the Wrens.
Yeah.
So somebody introduced him to Abe Saperstein, and Abe Saperstein said, I can go get you some more games. I can get you at least 10 games. And while Abe was out there trying to get games for this guy and his team, Abe started to get games for his own team. And because back then, if you had an all-black team, if that team had Harlem in part of its name, automatically said two things. One, that your team was all black, and two, they were from New York.
Yeah. Right.
And so the Harlem Globetrotters came about in 1927.
See?
You know,
so
5 years
that,
after the Wrens.
Wow.
Right.
And Abe's whole goal was to get them to the level of the Wrens. Now, when people think of the Harlem Globetrotters, they think of them as being a clown show or entertainment show, but the Harlem Globetrotters started out as a real basketball team.
Correct.
Wow, look at that. See, you know, and like I said, this is something that nobody thinks about when they think about not only basketball, but the Harlem Globetrotters, you know.
Exactly.
Nate put that up because, you know, that's something that a lot of people have a misconception about with the Harlem Globetrotters. I've actually done a little bit of research on them myself, and you know, you're absolutely right. There's this misnomer out there that they're kind of a clown team.
Yeah, but they started out as a legitimate team. Now, the part about them clowning, this is really interesting. The Wrens had a philosophy, right? They had a philosophy to what they call get 10, because they know a lot of times when they would play these teams that the refs was going to cheat them and do certain things. So they always wanted to come out real early and get a 10-point lead.
Yeah.
And back in those days, since they had no shot clock, if you got a 10-point lead, you could kind of milk that. Okay.
Right.
And they also, when they know they could blow a team out, not to beat a team by more than 10, not to blow them out, because if they did, then that team might be more inclined not to want to play them again.
Mm-hmm.
And so they needed to make money, so they said, so their philosophy, let's keep it close, let's make them think that they can win, and so this way we can always schedule another game. Now, Abe Saperstein took that philosophy and said, okay, if we're beating a team by a lot of points, what we're going to start to do is we'll pass the ball and we'll start to clown around and make a show of it. And that's where that came about.
Yeah.
Oh.
But you know what? If they didn't do that, would the Harlem Globetrotters be around today? You know, that's the thing. You know,
because
the Harlem Wrens were such a phenomenal basketball team, and you know, like all these other Barnstormer teams, they all disappeared. But Harlem Globetrotters basically just turned around and took it to a different level.
Right, because eventually, what happened was they went from using that as a gimmick to it being their staple.
Yeah.
Right.
You know,
right.
And in the long haul, they, you know, Abe Saperstein saw the money in it. Like, hey, we could go around the world entertaining people guys that could really play basketball and play it so well that they could afford to clown around. Okay, because you have to be really good to get a kind of lead like that and to clown around and still not lose the game.
Yeah.
So.
But
there was difference in philosophy.
Definitely.
In that. And also with the Harlem Wrens and with their owner, Bob Douglas, a couple of things he wanted to prove, right? He wanted to prove that if you have a love for something and you had a great passion for it and you tried to play it to perfection, that it would stand the test of time.
Absolutely.
And also, he wanted to prove through the game of basketball and playing it at such an excellent level that black people as a whole could not only do that on a basketball court, but also could do that in other areas of American life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there was a social aspect to what the Wrens were trying to do as well.
Definitely. Well, you know, let's talk about your movie, though, that you're making here, because this is something that, you know, you're holding really dear to yourself.
Right.
You know, I know you were close to John Isaacs, who was a Wrens player for
right.
many years, but what, you know, what drove you to want to make this the movie? And also, you know, please tell our listeners, you know, is there a potential date that this movie is going to come out?
Okay.
You know, and, you know, all the information based around this movie you're making.
All right. Well, all your questions are excellent. First of all, when I was playing high school ball and I was playing in tournaments like the Rucker and Citywide in New York and winning these tournaments, I heard about the Wrens.
Yes.
So that's the Wrens were kind of implanted on my brain, but I didn't know their story. But in 1999, I was running a summer pro league in L.A., and I was on the NBA.com website, and it had a story called Remembering the Wrens.
Mm-hmm.
And in this article on the NBA website, it kind of detailed the Wrens' history. I mean, like, it was the first time I ever really, you know, saw in print their story. And I was so awestruck by it,
yeah.
right? And by this time, I was really, you know, kind of immersed in the business of Hollywood. And it just came to me, I wanted to tell their story.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time, I was developing a TV show with Danny Glover and his production company, Kerry Productions.
Yeah.
And this TV show I was developing was about a fictional NBA team that was in L.A., that moved from L.A. to Las Vegas. Okay?
Okay.
And at the same time as I was developing this show, I started to do research and started to try to put together a development of trying to do a feature-length movie about the New York Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Doing research, contacting some people, and this when I initially met John Isaac through the legendary coach Sid Jones.
Yeah.
So meeting him, having him tell me some things more so than what I could read and research, I started to develop this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, I started to do a little documentary short. I started to work with this director, commercial director, whose name is Joe Pitka, who is the preeminent commercial director in American history. Every time you watch the Super Bowl, he has four or five or so commercials on.
Mm-hmm.
And so in developing their story and putting some things together, over the years, you know, I was able recently to get a script, to put together a pitch video, which is on YouTube, and start to put all the elements together to be at a point where we can about to go into production within, you know, maybe the third quarter of this year and then have a release sometime in 2014.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the Wrens story is so immense. You could tell 100, you can make 100 movies.
Yeah.
So you have to have a point of view. So this particular movie is going to deal with the period of time from 1937 to 1939, all right? So it's going to be a period piece,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right? And when you make a movie that's a period piece, you have to really transport the viewer,
yeah.
the movie viewer, back to that time.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to make it very authentic, right? And you have to make it entertaining. Even though this is a true story, you want it to be entertaining. You want people to be dazzled. You want them to be, you know, amazed, and at the end also learn something.
Definitely.
Yeah.
But definitely.
But have a great movie going experience.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what I'm trying to get done is to have an IMAX 3D version of the movie.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That would be nice.
Black and white?
No.
No?
Oh, no. No, no. Color.
I was going to say, that would really make it a period piece if you could do it in black and white.
Well, you know, that's an interesting concept. That's an interesting concept. We could, you know, later on, when you go into the DVD market, give the viewer the option to see it in black or white if they so choose, or see it in color. But yeah. but my mind is to do everything in color.
Yeah. Now, do you have a screenplay? Do you have a screenplay written?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes. We have all of that. Well, matter of fact, as we speak, we're trying to put together with some major actors to sign on board. We have Danny Glover already, of course. But,
yeah.
You know, it's moving at light speed. Let me say that.
That's now, what can you release to us? What role is Danny Glover playing?
He's going to play a role. He's not going to be one of the major roles, but a significant role of a character that before the Wrens play in the big tournament plays a major impact in their decision to go and play in this tournament.
Okay.
Yeah. So is there
Danny
like
Glover,
an EPA on?
Danny Glover brings so much humanity to any role he plays.
Yeah, you know,
and you know, as a filmmaker, when you make a film, a film of substance, you want it to have impact. And if I was pitching it to you and your fans to give them a visual sense of what this is going to look like, I would say to you that this movie would have the opulence and style of the movie The Great Gatsby,
mm-hmm.
but with the emotional depth of Lincoln. So
wow.
Have you seen the Lincoln movie?
Yep.
With Daniel Day-Lewis, and they're doing a remake of The Great Gatsby with Leonardo DiCaprio. If you see those movies and you see the style, the opulence, you see the way they were filmed, and then you see the emotional depth, especially of Lincoln, you put all that together, this is what the Renaissance Men is going to look like.
Wow.
All right. Well, Nate, you know what? One question before we let you go, you know, because, you know, we have some other things to touch on, unfortunately, but is there an ETA on when you guys are going to start, you know, production on this movie, or?
There's not a set ETA, but we're looking in the third quarter, you know, probably because we're going to have some NBA players.
Yeah.
We're going to have a mixture of great actors, and we're going to have NBA players
mm-hmm.
who have acting ability that's going to be a part of this project. And mm-hmm. I've already, you know, like when we did the HBO movie about Earl Manigault, that's what we did. We had a lot of NBA players like
right.
Joe Smith, and we had Kevin Garnett, Pooh Richardson.
Right.
So we're looking at sometime in July when the NBA season is over.
Okay.
During the summertime, just before the season starts up again in October and November.
Very nice. Well, Nate, you know what? Honestly, thank you for joining us today and telling all our listeners about your movie coming out, and hopefully when you know, you start getting into production on it and it's getting ready to come out, maybe we can get you on again to talk, you know, some
yes.
more about it.
Oh, yeah,
yes,
when it's released.
Sure.
Yep.
I want to thank you for having me on, and I also want to say to your listeners, go to the Facebook page, Renaissance Men,
yep.
on Facebook, and check out our video on YouTube, Renaissance
yep.
Men Danny Glover.
Yep.
And also, we'll actually be posting that up on our Fan Junkies page as well, so we can get that out there for you, man.
Yep.
And we appreciate it. And I appreciate you guys taking the time to have me on, and I enjoyed it. And hopefully, like I said, as we start to get a definite production date, we'll stay in touch with you, let your listeners
good.
Know. The best way they can stay in tune is with the Renaissance Men Facebook page.
You got
great.
It.
All right, Nate, thank you so much, man. We hope to talk to you sometime in the near future about it.
All right. Thanks, Jonathan. Thanks for having me on, and have a great day.
You,
all right.
Hey, thank you, buddy.
See you, Nate.
Okay, bye-bye.
A lot of basketball history, like we said,
wow.
would be discussed, and there you go.
Fascinating. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah, there you go. Nate is really just, you know, has his feet right into the basketball history of this whole thing. Not many people realize that Harlem Wrens, you know, a lot of trickle-down effect. Harlem Globetrotters, legendary coach John Wooden, you know, straight
yep.
into what the NBA is today.
Yeah,
it's definitely going to be a movie people are going to want to watch.
Fascinating stuff, really.
Yeah, and, you know, hopefully, you know, like I said, when it gets into production and starts to get out there, maybe we can get him on and maybe at the same time even do a little bit of a roundtable and get him and, you know, some actors on it. Maybe even Danny Glover can join us and talk some about it. So
yeah, very good.
Yeah, we'll see what happens there. But, you know, thank you, Nate, for coming on, and we'll definitely push out the Renaissance Men movie for you because we're excited about it. So. All right, we only got about a little under 14 minutes left in the show here, Mike. So let's talk football because it's the football playoffs this weekend. We had four games going. So let's talk about Saturday's games real quick. Houston and Cincinnati. Really wasn't anything of a shell shock there. We both, said that Houston could possibly win this game.
Mm-hmm.
We went with the experience. Matt Schaub, Andy Dalton, both didn't look good. But Arian Foster, what did I say, man? If they're going to have a shot, Arian Foster has to come back and look like Arian Foster. 32 carries, 140 yards, one touchdown. That led Houston to a 19-13 win. Texans, they're moving on, Mike.
Yeah, well, okay, you could talk Arian Foster, but the game ball really should go to Shane Graham. I mean, let's get it straight. They had four field goals.
Yes.
This is what Houston is now offensively. They're a field goal kicking team. I mean, seriously, I'm going to tell you right now, Houston...
Four field goals, they still would have lost.
They're getting knocked out in the second round, all right?
Absolutely.
This team is just... You know, Cincinnati, they should have beaten them by a lot more than 6 points.
Yeah.
All right? And we have talked about it and said it now for the past couple of weeks, that Houston really does not look like the same sort of team that they were in the beginning of the season and at midseason point. And they have shown it now for the better part of the last month.
Mm-hmm.
This game was absolutely horrible, really, to watch. It was slow. It was boring. both teams were ineffective. Yes, all right, fine. Arian Foster lit up a little bit here and there, and it made for some exciting plays. But for the most part, this was a really, really uninspiring game to watch.
Mm. So basically, whichever team won this game is not winning round two.
No, there's no way. We already know that Houston's going to play New England. That'll be the last game next Sunday. That'll be at 4:30. But I don't care who Houston plays. That, you know, they could play the Baltimore Ravens or the Denver Broncos. And the fact of the matter is, Houston's losing.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get to the next game then, quick here. Packers and Vikings. Packers win 24-10. Joe Webb. Who saw this guy coming into the game? Christian Ponder didn't even play.
Did he come into the game? Did Joe Webb really come into that game?
11 of 30, 180 yards with one touchdown. So, yeah, he was in the game.
Oh, okay. I wasn't quite sure who that was.
Yeah.
He was sacked three times, ended up with a 54.9 QB rating. You had to know almost from the beginning as soon as it was announced. And they waited. They waited quite a while there to announce that Ponder wasn't playing. But almost as soon as you heard it, you had to go.
You knew right away Green Bay was winning.
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously.
At the same time, you can't particularly blame Joe Webb. This is a guy that hasn't been in a game all season. And all of a sudden, that morning, he walks in and says, guess what? You're starting today against the Green Bay Packers in the NFL playoffs.
Well, wait a minute. What the heck was going on with Minnesota? Now, Ponder apparently incurred some sort of an elbow injury in the game previous. All right. So it was the week before in the finale against Green Bay. Are you trying to tell me that Minnesota had no clue and they sprung this on this guy that morning? I mean, seriously.
Was it just me or did you even know that Christian Ponder had a concern?
No, they kept it. Obviously, they kept it very, very quiet. I understand why, I suppose. But at the same time, you got to, during the course of the week, I haven't read all the background on it, but they had to have an inkling at some point or another that there was a possibility the Ponder wouldn't play. How many snaps did Webb take during the course of the week?
Supposedly he took some like reps in the beginning of the week, but we've seen backup quarterbacks going into the playoffs take reps with the first team just in case anyway. So it's like,
sure.
That wasn't a telltale sign that Christian Ponder, anything was wrong with him. All of a sudden, boom, that day, he's got an elbow injury. Okay, what happened with this elbow injury? Where did it come from?
You're going into the biggest game of your entire season, all right? the week before you beat this team, okay, at home, and you're going in and you got to play them right again the very next week out at their house at Lambeau.
Yeah.
Going into the biggest game of the entire season, and you spring on your backup quarterback that he's going to go into the game?
Yeah. Unbelievable.
I mean, you know.
Well, you know what? It is for what it is, and they're done.
Well, I'll say
Green Bay moves on. So
Green Bay was good to their word. Adrian Peterson did not get 200 yards. No, he got more like 100. It was 99, actually.
Yeah, 99.
But they did slow him down, I will say this.
Well, you know what? Give Joe Webb 7 carries running. I mean, that's just 7 extra carries that AP could have used in that game. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
It is what it is. But anyway, let's move to a couple of other games here because we only have a few minutes left. Baltimore Ravens beat the Colts 24-9. Colts, you know, who knows what was up with them. They lost Bruce Arians that morning, their offensive coordinator, who had some trouble and had to be taken to the hospital, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But, I mean, honestly, you look at both sides of the ball here, this game was all Anquan Boldin. I mean, he was pulling down ducks from Joe Flacco that I was like, wow, how the heck did he make this catch? Then all of a sudden, a couple minutes later, oh, my God, that catch was even better than the first one he just made. You know, seriously, 145 yards with a touchdown from Boldin. I mean, even if they didn't have that, Ravens would have won this game. But he was the showstopper.
Yeah, he was the number one fantasy receiver in the entire league this past weekend. And I love the word you use, pulling down the ducks. Because, you know, really, you know, to me, that's what Flacco puts up there in the air. It's almost one of them is a duck.
Listen, that one catch that Boldin made, that ball didn't come into him. It came straight down like it fell from the clouds. And it was just wobbling. I'm like, seriously, man? And he still made that catch. Unbelievable performance from Anquan Boldin yesterday.
Yep.
Ravens move on. You know, Colts, great run for them, I guess, this year, you can say, Mike. But
yeah,
they finally met a bigger and better team in the playoffs.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I mean, you know, I kind of thought that we were going to see a little more fire out of them, even against the Baltimore team. Listen, there was no doubt about it. You know, I picked Indianapolis, and I said last week, I said, listen, I could be completely wrong on this one. Boy, oh boy, I'm going to tell you, I knew I was wrong as soon as you saw that defense, that Baltimore defense, come out onto the field.
Well,
that Baltimore defense was
anyway.
Jacked.
Yeah,
they were
jacked. So.
And look at what they did. 10 quarterback hits on Luck. 10.
Then
right?
Still, the Indianapolis Colts, they're going up against a bigger and better team than the Colts. Seriously, do you think they're going to come out of the second round, Mike?
Baltimore?
To a Flacco throwing ducks like that?
No.
Okay.
No.
Listen, Anquan Boldin not having that performance again.
No, I would agree with you. I don't think he will. You're going to be playing at Denver. I don't see that happening. Denver's defense is okay. But it'll be close. It'll be closer than this game was, I think.
Oh, yeah.
The Denver Ravens game. But it'll be. But Denver comes out of that one on.
Yeah,
on top.
We'll talk about that on Friday. We'll throw out our round two predictions there. So basically, last game on the scrap heap last night was Washington Seattle. We said this is probably going to be the most exciting game. It unfortunately didn't end up to be that way. Washington lost 24-14. Seattle moves on to the second round. Let's talk real quick about this. RG3 goes down.
Yep.
Knew he was injured. There was a lot of stuff going on where, you know, Mike Shanahan threw Dr. Andrews under the bus saying he cleared him a couple of weeks ago when he really didn't. Here we go again. Mike Shanahan thinking about this playoff win instead of the future of the Washington Redskins organization. Possible ACL damage for Robert Griffin III. Who knows right now? What the hell went on with this game, Mike?
I'll tell you, as I'm watching it, and we talked about this pre-show, Jonathan, as I'm watching it live, and you saw him go down for the last time, my first reaction here at the frat house was I said, oh, my gosh, you wait and see. Washington is absolutely going to get lambasted for this move.
Yeah.
It was so obvious that RG3 should have been pulled out of that game, and yet they kept him out there. And, you know, I've heard the media going both ways on this.
Mm.
I've heard the media saying exactly what I'm saying, that, in fact, it was absolutely unwise to keep him in the game. I've had others who have indicated the complete opposite, that you can't blame Shanahan, you can't blame the management on the sideline, because players being players, they want to play the game.
So, it's up to the coach to think about the organization, to think about the player, and make the best possible decision, you know, he can make.
Absolutely.
Mike Shanahan didn't make the best possible decision he could have made yesterday.
I agree 100%. 100% I mean, agree with you.
Honestly, you could have not only ended a rookie's career and a very damn good football player, but at the same time, take away the franchise player of the Washington Redskins and hamper their future.
Robert Griffin, it was so obvious that for most of the game he was ineffective. He only ended the game with 84 yards.
Yeah.
They really – and look, when you got – and I made this comment to you yesterday. I won't say comparable. I will not say comparable quarterback. But when you've got a competent backup quarterback in Kirk Cousins, and we've seen him play, you go to him sooner in that particular game. Particularly when you can see that RG3, what really wasn't effective even through the first half.
Yeah. Well, not even that. You know what? You put Kirk Cousins in, you rely more on Alfred Morris. I mean, he only had 16 carries.
Yes.
Seriously.
Yes.
But yet he still got 80 yards.
Yes, but that Seattle defense was doing a pretty darn good job of locking him up.
They were. You know what? You have to give props to the Seattle defense. They did a phenomenal job yesterday. But comes down to this, you know, my opinion, Mike Shanahan, I think he was wrong in what he did yesterday. And, you know, for RG3's sake, let's hope, you know, he's okay and comes back healthy for next season.
Well, one final point on it, as I brought up pre-show, and I want to bring it up for the audience to just remember. This is not the first time we've had a situation like this where Washington has been questioned. That is, the team management has been questioned with regard to the usage of RG3. You might recall that back earlier on in the season, there were arguments that, in fact, the team did not follow on-the-field protocols when with a concussion that RG3 had suffered.
Yes,
so,
exactly. Yeah.
This is not the first time we've seen this sort of thing.
Yeah, no, it's not. Well, we'll talk more about it on Friday, as we throw out our second-round predictions. Unfortunately, we only have a very few minutes left in the show here. So, you know, we have to plug some upcoming shows. But first, we want to thank Nate Bellamy for joining us today. You can check out Renaissance Men on Facebook just by typing in Renaissance Men in the search bar. We'll also link up to it on fanjunkies.net. As well as our Twitter account. We'll send it out as there as well, so keep an eye on that. Join it. You know, Danny Glover is going to be in the movie. Some NBA players are going to be in the movie. It's going to be a really good movie. I'm psyched about it. And once again, thank Nate for coming on and talking Renaissance Men and basketball history with us. It was really interesting. Wednesday show, we have WFAN Jets beat reporter, newest beat reporter for WFAN, Chris LaPresti. We're going to be talking New York Jets football on Wednesday. And, of course, the insanity going on there. On Friday, WIFL Women's Indoor Football League Commissioner Dion Lee is going to join us to speak about the WIFL, what drove him to start the WIFL, and also talk about the Combine Tryouts that are going to be going on across the United States. So if you're a female and you're interested in trying out for the WIFL, we'll also post the dates of where the WIFL will be in the country starting January 12th going up to August 31st. And you can head out to the tryouts there. Definitely going to be interesting, Mike, to hear from Dion.
Yep.
And, of course,
yep.
Chris on Wednesday. So
yep.
It's going to be good. As always, check out FrathouseSports.net, where you can see our very own Mike McShane, Sidekick, and the group, and the gang doing 5 minutes at the Frat House on Thursdays. And if you can't check it out, Frat House Thursdays will be here on Fan Junkies Radio on Saturdays.
Yeah.
First debuted Saturday, and it was great. Hundreds of listeners. It was amazing for a Saturdays for something we didn't promote, Mike.
Yeah, it was. I thank everybody who listened in.
Yeah, absolutely. So, once again, for Mike McShane, I'm Jonathan Ragus. Thank you for listening to Fan Junkies Radio, and we'll see you all on Wednesday when we are joined by WFAN Jets reporter Chris LaPresti. Thank you so much. We'll see you all then.
Catch you then.
Maybe you're a 49ers fan in Jacksonville or a Jets fan in Houston, and you're looking to connect with fellow fans from hundreds or thousands of miles away. Look no further than FanJunkies.net. FanJunkies.net is a social networking site dedicated to fans of every team and every league. Connect with baseball, football, basketball, and hockey fans from throughout the country and throughout the world. Get the latest news, take polls, and interact in live chats on game day. And best of all, it's absolutely free to join. Sign up today at FanJunkies.net. FanJunkies.net, where sports meet social networking.